Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the aging brain. What happens to our brains as we age, and what might be the signs that it might be something more serious, like dementia? Joining us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning.
Good morning.
Social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning.
And author and neuroscientist Lisa Genova. She's the author of Remember, the Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Mindy.
So I think many of us at a certain age start to wonder if we're forgetting, or it might be, you know, like not just normal forgetting, or if it's something more serious. You know, why did I come into this room? What was that person's name again? You know, it's not a time to panic. Sometimes we panic going, oh, my God, I must be, you know, getting Alzheimer's or some form of dementia. But it happens to most of us as we age. Right, Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, it actually happens to all of us at every age. We just tend to notice it more as we get older because old age and memory impairment and Alzheimer's are now on your radar. And we do have an uptick in the frequency of some of these things, like, oh, what's his name? And why did I come in this room? But all of those examples that you've just given are normal and happen to 25-year-olds as well as 55-year-olds.
Let's talk about cognitive decline. We shouldn't see cognitive decline, or do we expect cognitive decline? What's happening in our brains?
So no, you should not expect cognitive decline. So that's a myth. Memory loss is not a normal part of normal aging. So if you're noticing something that's not normal, then that's when you should raise your hand and be in conversation with your doctor and family. What are you guys noticing? Talk to your doctor. You want to pay attention to your brain health as much as you would your heart health. But most of what people are panicked about every day is totally normal. So the, oh, what's his name? Like, our brains are not designed to remember proper nouns really well. So people's names, cities, movie titles, book titles. So the, oh, what's his name? Think of names as living in neurological cul-de-sacs. They're really tricky to reach. And that's true at every age. Why did I come in this room? That happens to all of us. That has to do with context. The new room actually interferes with your ability to remember what you went in there for. So that's not a sign of cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's either. But there are distinctions. So like, where did you put your stuff? Like, where did I leave my glasses? Where's my phone? Where did I put my keys? Where did I park my car? Probably is a symptom of distraction. You didn't pay attention to where you put these things, and you can't create a memory if you didn't pay attention to the thing. But it's something different if, like, well, I went to the mall and I parked in the garage and I can't remember if I parked on level 3 or 4. That's probably because you didn't pay attention. But if you're thinking, I can't remember how I got here, or if you can't remember what kind of car you drive, or you're standing in front of your car and you don't recognize it as yours. So that's a distinction that's not normal.
Yeah. Mark, what's happening in our brains as we age? Our brain shrinks a little bit, right?
Oh, it shrinks because nerve cells die. Nerve cells are not readily replaced. They are replaced, but not in a robust fashion. We're not like other animals that can replace a missing limb or something like that if it's cut off. So it's use, I think, and misuse and abuse. We're not very kind to our brains with what we eat, with what we how we drink, for instance. And our environment is ripe with opportunities for stress and depression. You know, depression is one of the risk factors for dementia because it's an abnormal brain state. And there's a lot, you know, depression has inflammation associated with it in the brain. And inflammation means death of neurons. Yeah, a number of things feed into it, but it's just a product of being alive for a number of years.
As you're mentioning, dementia, memory loss can come from other things besides dementia. Dementia is sort of the first thing we think of, right? But there are lots of other causes, physical causes, right? You're nodding your head, Lisa.
There are some reversible causes in medicine. That's real important to start ruling out. Thyroid disease is one of them. Medicines is another one. Side effect of medicines or other kind of toxins. So cardiovascular disease and traumatic brain injury, certainly. The football players are high risk here. And then sleep disorders, too. Sleep apnea. If you have undiagnosed and untreated sleep apnea, your brain is being robbed of enough oxygen while you're trying to sleep. And that does damage. And also cognitive inactivity is also one of the things that it can be related to.
It seems like one of the current themes that, and I'm certainly interested, Lisa, in your thoughts on this. It seems like one of the current emphases in neuroscience is on the importance of good sleep for reducing the risk of dementia. When I was in medical school, the thinking was that glial cells were kind of like these useless little things that kind of exist in the brain that did absolutely nothing. And of course, as we know, the arrogance of medicine leads us to believe that if we don't know what something does, then I guess it doesn't do anything. But it turns out that glial cells are really important in the daily cleaning up of dead cells, dead mitochondria, and all the other little bits and pieces that make the neurons and other parts of our brain work. I also think that in the past it was believed that as you get older, you don't need as much sleep, which I guess was sort of the conventional wisdom that came from how frequently older people don't sleep as long, whether that's because of chronic pain or other issues that are very common as we get older. But my understanding, again, please, Lisa, feel free to interrupt because I'm sure you know more about this than I do. But I think the current thinking is that that one of the things that most of us could do to reduce our risk for dementia is to do whatever we need to do to get a good night's sleep by addressing all the things that interfere with a good night's sleep.
Totally agree. Like, sleep is the foundation of your brain health and the health of pretty much every organ system in your body, truly. So that's really where you want to start. I'd also say exercise is like right behind it. Like, we're not meant to be sedentary, and we're meant to get 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. And so the brain shrinkage that Mark was referring to is also probably not a normal part of normal aging. It's a result of decades of poor sleep hygiene and being sedentary, among other things, maybe poor diet as well. There's like a whole list of things that can contribute over decades to having a smaller brain. But we also know through studies that if you get good sleep, if whatever you haven't slept is already water under the bridge. If you now work on getting, 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night, if you start incorporating movement into your daily calendar, that you can stimulate neurogenesis in important parts of your brain, like the hippocampus, which is essential for the formation of new memories. So yeah, sleep is huge. This is when your brain's sewage and sanitation department goes to work. Those glial cells that you just talked about, those are your brain's janitors, and they are essentially cleaning up the metabolic debris that accumulated in your brain while you were in the business of being awake. And one of the things that cl critically clears away is a protein called amyloid beta. Now, if amyloid is not cleared away, it's a sticky protein, it's insoluble, it'll bind to itself and form plaques. And if those plaques accumulate to a certain level, it then reaches a tipping point that then triggers a whole host of molecular events, including neurofibrillary tangles, neuroinflammation, which Mark alluded to, and cell death. So prior to the tipping point, you're symptom-free, you don't have Alzheimer's. We wouldn't diagnose you yet, but so you which is great news, because it means that you've got a window of time where you can do things that impact the accumulation of amyloid. And one of the things that you can do is every night that you can get yourself a good night's sleep, one of the things that's happening is you're clearing away those amyloids and you're reducing the plaque load, the amyloid plaque load. So also while you sleep, it's critical for memory. Like, everything that you paid attention to today, all the memories that you hope to keep from today, that you cared about, that you practiced, those events, that information becomes linked together into a stable neural circuit, into a memory that you can then retrieve. That happens while you sleep. So if you don't either get the right quality or quantity of sleep, some of what you hope to remember from today might be forgotten.
I wanted
What
to
about
bring.
naps, Lisa? Can you say something about naps? Are
Oh,
naps good for you or
naps.
not?
Good
Yeah, so
question.
naps can be helpful.
So your brain is is limitless in terms of the amount of information that you can remember long term. So if I want to learn all the words to all of the songs on the new Taylor Swift album at almost 55, I can do that. Anything you want to learn, you can. But short term, like before it gets consolidated into long term after I sleep, the hippocampus can be sort of overwhelmed and max out. So if I'm trying to learn a ton of vocabulary words, or if I'm trying to learn a lot of information all at once, my hippocampus can sort of not run out of room to hold all of that. A nap can be super helpful because it can kick sort of that information into consolidated long term. And then I wake up from the nap and I'm ready to learn more information. Also just can refresh you. If you're tired, it's going to be hard for me to pay attention. And if I can't pay attention, I can't make new memories. So a nap can give my brain a chance to sort of refuel the cognitive resource tank so that I have enough energy to pay attention to things. We think that about 20 minutes is the optimal amount of time for napping. If you go longer than that, you might be in a sleep phase that then, if you wake up, you have this sleep inertia. You feel kind of yucky, and you're sluggish. So anything shorter, 20 minutes or shorter, can be enough to feel refreshed and have your brain be alert and ready to learn new information.
You know, it's interesting that we are talking about this and putting this emphasis now on sleep, because we live in a culture where sleep and napping in particular is almost a dirty word. People talk about, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead, right? I was just recently listening to a fabulous podcast of one of the nation's great sleep experts, and he was saying about how actually sleep is one of the most productive things that a human being can do. And again, I think that's in keeping with what Lisa is saying. But it's really hard for those of us who have been, you know, working our tushies off all our lives to somehow wrap our heads around that notion that sleeping is actually very productive, creative, helpful, et cetera.
How many times would you wake up and you go, a problem you've had that you just can't figure out the answer to? You have a good night's sleep, you wake up in the morning, you're half awake, and you go, ah, there it is. There's the answer to my problem, right? I want to read something, a quote from your book, Lisa, that I think really kind of drives it home. You write, "If Big Pharma came out with a pill tomorrow that could improve your memory and significantly lower your risk of Alzheimer's, would you take it? How much would you pay for that medication? Well, we already have it. It's called sleep." That's how powerful sleep is.
Yeah, and to be fair to folks who are listening, sleep is hard for a lot of us. We live in a culture and a time that, like Dr. Schwartz said, is frowned upon. Like, oh, you're gonna sleep? Like, how wimpy of you! You should be up and being productive. And then, we have all these screens that emit lights that confuse our pineal glands into thinking it's still daytime, so it doesn't produce melatonin that it normally would in the evenings to help us become drowsy and create that sleep pressure that helps us fall asleep. We have all these factors working against us, either psychologically or physically, to help us get to sleep and stay asleep. So it's really tricky and hard for a lot of folks, right? Stress is really inhibits our sleep, our thoughts, our worries. We're anxious, and so our brain is going through all of the unfinished tasks of today, trying to figure things out. It's worried about tomorrow, so that can keep you up. If you drink alcohol can interfere with your ability to stay asleep, whether it's getting up to pee or interfering with REM sleep. So there's a lot of things that we do. If you're not exercising enough, so if you're sedentary, exercise really does help you. It improves the quality of your sleep, the quantity of your sleep, and reduces the number of times you wake up in the night. So we're behaving in lots of ways that are working against our ability to get optimal sleep.
Yeah.
And what about if sometimes I find in the middle of the day that if I just go lie down and sort of close my eyes, I don't even have to sleep. It can reset myself. Like I'm feeling exhausted and
Yeah.
achy and I can't think. And then if I just go lie down for a little bit, is that doing the same thing neurologically?
It's not quite the same thing, but like one thing that can happen to us, like if you're really trying to pay attention to something, so you're reading material or you're at a meeting, like you're focused, you're trying to sustain your attention, you're trying to focus on something and sustain that attention. Attention is a limited resource. Like that fuel tank will will drain and go to empty. And when that happens, you will feel exhausted. Like if any of you have ever like worked really hard on something cognitively, like you might feel like you've just run a 5K, like you're really tired. And the way to get back to feeling restored is to take a break from that sustained attention. So close your eyes and meditate, close your eyes and relax, even do a simple rote enjoyable activity. Like here, it's you're not building an Alzheimer's resistant brain here, Mindy, but if you're doing like, a crossword puzzle or gardening or knitting or anything that is just sort of rote and easy and relaxing for a few minutes, that can refill that attention fuel tank that will allow you to feel refreshed and able to cognitively go back to work without sleeping.
We're talking about the aging brain. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation or you have a question, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the aging brain this morning with psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, social worker Jenny Putnam, author and neuroscientist Lisa Genova. She's the author of Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Patrick's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Fascinating show. Really interesting. Thank you. I'm just going to throw out four things. They're short. I'd love it if you wanted to comment on any or all of these that I'm curious about. One is how sleep apnea figures into all of this. How ADHD, you talked a little bit about attention. I'm curious more if you have more to say about that. I'm very curious about some of the research that's been done for neurogenesis using psychotropics such as, to reverse even Alzheimer's. I remember Rick Perry, the politician guy from Texas, I saw in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, he swears that Ibogaine, which is a psychotropic drug from Africa, can reverse Alzheimer's. So, but I'm curious about your thoughts on any of those things.
Nope, on that one, yeah. Okay, and what's the fourth thing?
This gets a little bit more esoteric about any ideas about dreams and synchronicity and Carl Jung's ideas, but that doesn't, those things happen when you sleep, but maybe it's a little bit off the path.
Okay. All right. Patrick, thanks. Let's start with that. Sleep apnea. Thoughts on sleep apnea. How does that impact us?
I think I mentioned a little bit about it before. Sleep apnea means you stop breathing, no breathing, and it can last. It can last for half a minute, or even some people go 2 minutes or so, or even somewhat longer than that. And that means you're starving your brain of oxygen. You're injuring it repeatedly. That's why one of the signals that you might have sleep apnea is when you wake up with a loud noise, because there are other parts of your primitive brain that get turned on when the oxygen is lacking and wakes you up. I mean, that's a built-in thing, so you don't die. Although I guess it has been reported that people do die from apnea episodes. But at any rate, you're injuring your brain repeatedly. And I think that's the method that leads to cognitive impairment over time. Mm-hmm.
And what about ADHD? Any thoughts on ADHD? Tough for some.
Maybe
it's tough for some. Yeah, tough for some. Like I have a grandson who has ADHD, and I know when he goes to bed at night, he said he has a hard time shutting his brain off. His brain is just his thoughts are going, and it takes him quite a while to fall asleep. I mentioned before we went on the air, his pediatrician suggested melatonin, and well, he's like a new kid. He's actually sleeping more. But there's also some things to think about with that, Lisa. Right. So maybe you can address those two issues. The melatonin, good, but you have to be careful with it, right?
I think the point that Lisa was making earlier about the role of attention in memory is really important, because if you're not paying attention, you're not taking in whatever the data is. And frequently when people are being evaluated for ADHD, they will report that they're concerned about their memory. Mm-hmm. And it has to be pointed out that it's rare for people with ADHD to also have a memory issue. the problem is an attentional issue.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you're not storing the data, then of course you're not going to be able to retrieve it when you are looking for it because you never really took it in the first place. But with proper treatment of ADHD, all of a sudden the so-called memory problem disappears.
Yeah.
I also can say that it's hard to fall asleep because your brain is going on and on and on and on and on.
Right.
And so I find myself sometimes at night doing multiple things to try and quiet my brain so I can fall asleep. And some of them are counterindicated in other cases to do. So I might play a game on my phone and listen to a book and then I fall asleep. But if I am not fully engaging in that way, my brain starts going around and around and around and around and around.
Mm-hmm. Well, as somebody who's been taking Ritalin for ADHD for over 40 years, I can swear to you, I have no problem falling asleep ever, with rare exception. And so certainly it's not usually the case that people with ADHD automatically or almost automatically would have trouble falling asleep. But I think that for a lot of people, anxiety is a more common cause for that going around and around. And Jenny, I think you might want to have an anxiety workup there. But
you think?
And of course, there's a 40% association in people with ADHD to also have an anxiety disorder in addition or in parallel. And so that can be an issue. We typically see that when people with ADHD are being properly treated for the ADHD, those who were having sleep trouble often don't. And with kids, we sometimes will use, I think melatonin is a more generic kind of sleep supplement, but clonidine and a couple of other medicines sometimes can be used with good effect for sleep, but it's not really ideal to be taking sleep medicine if you can avoid it.
Yeah. You better
put it up. I
just want to jump in for a second what you just said, Jonathan, because I've been thinking it was his ADHD, but it is anxiety because the thoughts he's talking about are anxious thoughts. What if my friends are not my set friends when I'm grown up? I mean, thoughts way into the future. I mean, worrying about, so it I think you solved my thinking here. It's anxiety.
I'm sorry, I don't take your insurance.
Jonathan makes a very good point about differential diagnosis. I think that it's hard to it's hard to pinpoint sometimes what is going on with an individual. And to that point, I would love if Lisa could talk a little bit about menopause and cognitive function and sleep, et cetera.
Yeah. And just to like close a loop or add a little to that, like, you know, so the anxiety that can be comorbid with ADD or ADHD, it's interesting, like they're so intertwined in some ways, right? If you have ADHD and you're late for things and you're not completing your tasks and people are thinking that you're irresponsible or thinking that this is a, you know, a character flaw, it can be incredibly stressful and anxiety provoking to not be able to keep up with your days and not to be able to be organized. And so if you solve if you help and alleviate some of the ADHD symptoms, then maybe the anxiety then goes away because now you'll be able to complete your tasks. Mm-hmm. But anxiety is massive. It affects, and there was a survey, that was prior to January of 2025, where 80% of Americans said they feel stressed and anxious at least once or frequently every single day. And so we're probably hitting 100% of Americans at this point. So like, you know, people are experiencing stress and anxiety, and that can absolutely contribute to you not being able to fall asleep. So you want to find some things other than medications to knock you unconscious, because then you're not going to get the nuanced, biologically busy phases of sleep. You're not going to get the clearing of the plaques and other things that go on that are biologically specific. You're just being knocked unconscious. With respect to menopause, so not surprisingly, science hasn't studied women for very long. Back when I was in the lab in the 90s, you know, all of the research I did was on male rats and male mice, as was all research. So it's only recently that we've even studied female brains in animals, and then also in women. Like menopausal women are not have not been the priority in science and medicine. Maria Shriver is working on this. Lisa Moscone is working on this. So we know tiny, tiny bits. But what here's what I can tell you is that perimenopause and menopause is a period of time that often introduces massive interruptions in sleep. So women experiencing hot flashes, night sweats, this is disrupting your night's sleep. And so if you're chronically sleep disrupted, then you are probably cognitively foggy. And so if you can solve those symptoms through hormone therapy, if that's safe for you, which it is for the majority of women, then that solving sleep, if you can lay that foundation, you're going to improve so much. But there's lots of changes in the brain that happen during perimenopause and menopause that we don't entirely understand, and some of them could be contributing to having difficulties with sleep. But we know that these vasoactive symptoms are sort of the biggest culprits. So not being able to sleep because you're waking up in a puddle of water, night sweats and hot flashes. So the hot flashes, your whole body's hot and you wake up, your body temperature needs to drop for you to fall asleep. So like you want to set yourself up for success. You want your room ideally around 65 degrees, so that you can fall asleep. You want it to be really dark again, so your pineal gland can say, "Oh, it's dark. I should be releasing melatonin and making you drowsy." You want to make sure you're not drinking caffeine too late in the day. So people think like, "Oh, I'm having such a problems falling asleep, but I don't know what I'm doing." It's like, well, when was your last cappuccino? Did you have a latte after dinner at 7 p.m.? We all have different receptor sensitivities, but the half-life of caffeine is about 5 hours. And what does that mean? That means that's the amount of time it takes for half of the substance to be reduced by half. So if you have 64 milligrams of caffeine in your cappuccino after dinner at 7, you've still got 32 milligrams of caffeine buzzing around your brain and body at midnight, and that might
We got a little technical snafu
melatonin
there. Yeah.
helps you fall asleep.
Yeah.
I'm glad, Lisa, that you mentioned the subject of hormone replacement therapy, because I think that one of the biggest travesties in the last 30, 40 years has been the abolition of what's called HRT, hormone replacement therapy, as a result of a huge and gross misinterpretation of some studies that were done. And there are many, I mean, millions of women who would have and would still benefit from hormone replacement therapy who have not been offered it because of a misinterpretation of data in earlier studies. And certainly that's got to be relevant to not only getting good sleep, but therefore reducing at risks of cognitive impairment.
Right, and osteoporosis and on and on. Thank you so much for mentioning that. Yeah, we've not been done a service with respect to that. And I think a lot of even the language around it is changing too. It's called menopause hormone therapy. So the idea that we're not replacing something, that we are not lacking. It's just this is like something that we need to help us in that transition. So yeah, thank you. It's something that can benefit a lot of women, 10 years prior to going into menopause. If you're having trouble sleeping due to night sweats or hot flashes, you can address this with hormone therapy probably very safely and save your sleep.
Yeah. Katie writes, as a mom of two children, 1 and 4 years old, sleep is almost always interrupted. You mentioned quality and quantity of sleep. For parents with children 0 to 5 years old, what is more important for overall health, quality or quantity of sleep? That's a tough question.
I don't think we have the answer to that. And I also think, like, don't panic. Like, here's what we know is that you don't develop Alzheimer's overnight. You don't develop cognitive impairment overnight. We have a lot of resiliency and a large window of forgiveness here. So, right, like, for if we just think about women, like, there's pregnancy, there's nursing or feeding babies through the night, then there's toddlers who don't sleep through the night, and the next thing you know, you're in perimenopause and menopause. Men, you're of a similar age, your prostate starts to get enlarged, and you're up several times a night to pee. Like, Like, don't panic if you're in a phase of life where you're not getting consistent quality or quantity of sleep, and then do what you can to improve it. Like, if you have your goal set on every time I can give myself a good night's sleep, I am doing something good for my brain health and my memory. Like, that's a goal, right?
Earlier, Lisa, you were talking about short-term and long-term memory, and I wondered if you could just elaborate a little bit on that, like explaining, how short-term and long-term memory work, but are they impacted the same as we age? I mean, are there any differences?
So the name is a little bit of a misnomer. So like there's something called working memory, and that's kind of like your brain's scratch pad. It can hold only so much information. It's basically like trying to keep track of the present moment. And then there's a moment of deciding, like, is this something I want to keep or not? And working memory diminishes a little with age. Like, as we get older, we have a hard time tracking multiple things at once. So you might notice that as you get older, like, oh, I used to be able to, like, type an email while talking on the phone. It's really task switching. You're not actually focusing on everything at once, but the ability to sort of keep your mind tracking several things at once, in that sort of short-term space can be trickier as you get older. But then, if it's something that you want to keep, if it's something that's meaningful, emotional, surprising news, something that you paid attention to, something that you're repeating and practicing, that is then in a space of hasn't been consolidated into long-term memory yet, because that happens while you sleep. And so that's the short-term space. Things can happen that can keep it from going into long-term, like not getting right sleep, getting a concussion. Could prevent you from locking that into long-term memory. Drinking alcohol can keep it from locking into long-term memory later. So there's the very, very, very short term called working memory, where it's like this is, allows you to remember the beginning of a sentence by the time you reach the end of the sentence. So that's super short term. It's someone tells you a phone number or a Wi-Fi passcode, and like, can you remember that? Like, that's that short term. And then there's the, like, okay, I've got stuff I want to remember, hopefully tomorrow, next week, 30 years from now, but it's not a long-term memory yet until I've had a chance to go to sleep, and that information then gets linked together then, and then it becomes long-term.
Okay. Marianne writes, one thing that can help settle a free-running brain is an MP3 player with a favorite audiobook. The familiar book, Played Low, Night After Night, is soothing, slightly interesting, but a little bit boring, so you can drift off, and it's still with you after a bathroom trip. Marianne, thank you for that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, we're talking about the aging brain. With us this morning is author and neuroscientist Lisa Genova. She's the author of Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting. Social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So the good news here is there are things that we can do to improve brain health, and most of it's lifestyle changes. One thing that drives me crazy, and Lisa, I know you have thoughts on this. You go online, somebody's game, they go, a neuroscientist says we must, play this game to, ward off dementia or Alzheimer's. Not true, right? Memory games might be fun to play, but they're not going to cure Alzheimer's.
No, there is no cure for Alzheimer's right now. So anyone who's out there saying that they have a supplement, a protocol, a game that prevents or reverses Alzheimer's, they are lying to you. They're probably being sued as well. That's not true. If there's a chiropractor on Facebook or a podcaster or someone on TikTok or YouTube telling you they've got the cure or the reversal of Alzheimer's, they're scamming you.
Yeah.
So please don't believe that.
Right. And we talked about sleep being important. So let's talk about some of the other things. You mentioned diet. And I think of Rudy Tanzi, who does amazing research in Alzheimer's. He's amazing. But he always says what's good for the heart is good for the brain, right? So that's what we should think about when we're looking at diet.
Yeah, and I actually don't even love using the word diet. Again, language matters so much because I
Right.
think, like, you know, if you're of a certain age, you associate diet with deprivation and weight loss. And it's not about that. This is about, I like to use the word menu instead. So you're choosing from a menu of foods that supports your brain health and reduces your risk of developing Alzheimer's in the future. So the menus you can Google are the Mediterranean or Mind, MIND menu of foods. So it's leafy greens, vegetables, brightly colored berries, olive oil, nuts, fish, multigrain, beans. So those are the foods that we know we have evidence-based research that show that they support your memory today and reduce your risk of Alzheimer's in the future.
So we talk about memory games don't work, but things like taking up a musical instrument, there are things we can do, right, that are good for our brain that do create connections, like challenging it like a musical instrument, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting.
Right, Lisa, we
You
had your
want them.
fade out there a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you now. Yep.
Okay, so you want to learn new things and you want them to be complex things. You want them to be things that like reading a book and being in a book club, maybe learning a musical instrument, a new sport, traveling to a new city. And we think this is because every time you learn something new, you're creating new neurological connections, new synapses. And if Alzheimer's is ultimately a disease of losing synapses, then that means we can be resilient to the presence of Alzheimer's pathology if we have more what we call cognitive reserve. We have more neural connections so that we can maybe dance around and detour any neurological blockages, any Alzheimer's blockages. So you can imagine if I had, for simplicity's sake, if I have only 10 ways to get to something I want to remember, 10 roads, imagine your neurons as roads, and I have Alzheimer's blocking all 10 of those roads, I can't get to that address. That thing is forgotten forever. But if I build more neural pathways, let's say I learn 100 things about that address. Now I have 100 roads leading to that address, and I have Alzheimer's blocking 10. I still have 90 ways to get there. So when we learn complex new things, if we stay lifelong learners, we are building more neural pathways, building more neural roads, and we are building this cognitive reserve that makes us resilient to the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, even if we have some of that pathology present in our brains.
Mark from Sagamore asks, can neurofibrillary tangles be caused by traumatic incidents?
They can be caused by traumatic brain injuries. They can be caused by like concussions and CTE, as we see in the football players. But I'm not aware of it being caused by something psychologically traumatic. I don't know about the rest of the folks here.
Well, I think if you have a PTSD, you're stressing your brain all the time. So from that standpoint, it might hasten or have cognitive impairment appear earlier rather than later. So by that way, I think is a way, a pathway to worsening cognitive impairment, chronic stress in like from PTSD.
Getting back to what Lisa was saying about food, nutrition, I like the way Michael Pollan, who's written so much about food, says it. He says there's really only three rules about how to eat. Eat food, which basically, by which he means, it's not things that were created in a laboratory. Don't eat too much of it, and eat mostly a plant-based, diet. So I like that a lot. I also feel that as the local TMS representative, I should add that TMS is currently being used, although it's not yet FDA cleared, to treat mild cognitive impairment and has shown some ability to reverse early cognitive deficits. And Lisa, if you'd ever like to visit our office in Yarmouthport or Mashpee and see TMS for yourself, if you haven't already, you'd be very welcome to see it.
Janet's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Listen, I am an 84-year-old woman, and so far I don't think I have dementia or anything like that. However, I have a tremendous amount of things I have to remember. So I utilize the 3x5 cards to write them down daily. I have a horse to take care of, a cat that's in end-stage kidney disease, a house to manage, friends to keep up with, medical stuff to deal with. So far, I seem to be able to do it, but it takes me longer to do this.
Right. Janet, you're too busy. You're too busy. Your brain is busy. And Lisa, we slow down, right? I mean, she's still able to do all this, but a little bit slower.
Yeah, and she's not too busy. If she's not overwhelmed, if she's not stressed and burdened by this, then it's wonderful to stay cognitively active and physically active. But yes, our processing.
We have Lisa fading out again a little bit there. I'm not sure what's happening with the Zoom here. Janet mentioned something interesting, which I think we could all find useful. And Mark, that's lists, right? Making lists.
Oh yeah, yeah. Anything you can come up with as a crutch, basically, and train yourself to do it, and train yourself to write things down on a note. And, you know, maybe you have to remember where the note is, but, it's an extra challenge. Use all sorts of, tools to help you. I think the woman that just called could be a great example for us all to follow in terms of how she manages her life. Mm-hmm. In spite of the slowing down. She's not overwhelmed and she's not impaired. One of the simple statements that have been made in terms of distinguishing normal aging cognitive changes with dementia is if the thing that's bothering you is frustrating, but it's not disabling, it's likely aging that's causing it. Mm-hmm. And if it's interfering with daily life, then it's likely dementia.
Yeah.
There's the simple equation you can use to start to distinguish.
Janet gave us a few good tips. She mentioned lists. She also mentioned keeping up with her friends. Yeah. Social connections are critical. Jenny, you're nodding your head, right? Social connections. We don't want to be isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that helps with anxiety, which then helps with sleep, and all kinds of good things happen when you have social connections. I was also curious about the animals she cares for. Like, I think that a lot of us, as we age, we don't have children that we can. I mean, there's a period of time when we're taking care of kids and our parents for many people. But then there's also those of us who are not caring for anything other than ourselves anymore. And I know that when you take care of other people, that can also reduce your anxiety. And so I was curious to hear all of the, you know, the horse and the cat that she has to continue to take care of. Although the horse also, I assume, gets her exercising.
Right. Purpose, right? It also gives you purpose.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Meaning making, I think, is huge for all of those of us.
Janet, thanks for the call and the inspiration. Janet gave us a lot of good tips there. Lisa, one of the things, too, is when we think about remembering, we don't remember sort of the mundane everyday things, like what did I have for breakfast on Monday? I don't know, unless I have the same thing every day. So emotion and surprise really also impact what we remember, right?
Yes, it's what's meaningful, emotional. These are the elements that our brains have evolved to remember. We do not remember, and it is normal for our brains not to remember what is same old, predictable, routine, habitual, inconsequential. So you don't remember what you had for lunch last Wednesday if it was same old, probably a sandwich, a salad. But if it was someone's birthday, if it was an anniversary, if there was something that happened, you got like a bomb of a news on that day. Like you'll remember that lunch. Mm-hmm. This is why we often remember where we were on emotional days. Like you got news of an engagement or 9/11. Like you remember highly emotional, surprising events and all of the things that happened around that emotional event.
Right. Bonnie writes, I've had very difficult sleep for 30 plus years since perimenopause. I will not take sleep drugs. I eat very well and am active and have good sleep hygiene. My healthcare provider said I'm too old for estrogen replacements. Thoughts? Yeah, there is a point where it doesn't work for us who have a certain age, right?
Yeah, the thinking is it's if you're 10 years out of your menopausal date, so we say you go into menopause when you've had 1 year of no period, and if it's been 10 years after that, the data suggests that there's not enough of a benefit and that you can actually have some health risks at that point for going on menopause mm-hmm. hormone therapy. Yeah. So yeah, unfortunately that's true.
The single best treatment for insomnia is at least currently thought to be what's called CBTI, which is a type of cognitive behavioral therapy that really is aimed at insomnia, the I standing for insomnia. And it's really based on the notion that instead of trying to sedate the hell out of your brain, which is what we're doing with our prescription medications and our even over-the-counter medications, in other words, to sort of depress or suppress the central nervous system into oblivion, so a person is therefore sleeping. Instead, let's take a look at the arousal state that the person is in and contend with that, manage that, deal with that, because that for most people who have insomnia, they can retrieve a normal sleep architecture and a normal amount of sleep by tackling the sort of, abnormal degree of arousal that is making it difficult for their brain to shut off and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. So the trick is to find a cognitive behavioral therapist who has some expertise in CBTI. And that's what I generally recommend to people before we start using lots of medicines. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. About 30 seconds left. Lisa, we'll give you the final thought.
Oh, gosh. Well, just to piggyback on that, like our brains are meaning-making, pattern-recognizing prediction machines. And so for applying that to sleep, like if you can come up with a reliably predictable, consistent routine that hits a lot of the senses. So it's the same time of night that you're going to go to sleep. You always maybe play the same soothing playlist. You maybe use a moisturizer with a lavender scent, a soothing scent that you only use at bedtime. If all of these cues are reliable, they will come to predict falling asleep. Mm-hmm. And so like Pavlov's dog who salivates to just the sound of the bell eventually. Yeah. So sleep is big, exercise, what you eat, lowering stress, and learning new things. These are all going to serve you today and reduce your risk of Alzheimer's in the future.
All right. Neuroscientist Lisa Genova, author of Remember the Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting, social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.